Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMCortho.
Well, welcome back to the Vox Pop WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Today we have a great guy, Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians, in the studio to discuss internal medicine and nephrology. He's board certified in both areas. Dr. Carcillo has been with CDRP since 2004 and is the current president and managing partner of this rather extensive practice. A graduate of the University of Scranton, he completed medical school at the Philadelphia School of Osteopathic Medicine. He trained in nephrology at Albert Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia. His clinical interests include transplant, nephrology, and hypertension. Vince Carcillo, welcome to the program. Always great to have you here.
Good afternoon, Alan. Thanks so much for having me.
Everybody likes you. To be part of today's conversation, give us a call at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Well, it's an important week in nephrology, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's National Kidney Month, so there are so many things going on in the kidney community.
So how does one celebrate National Kidney Month?
There are a number of ways. One of them would be to get in touch or see what the National Kidney Foundation is doing. They've got a website and lots of things that they're sponsoring right now. One of them is right in our area at SUNY. They're doing a walk and 5K run. That's going on June 8th, but they're doing that in a number of places around the area at different times. The schedule's on their website.
And anything exciting going on, any new wrinkles in terms of how people are being treated or any of that?
Yeah, in different areas. I mean, one of them would be the area of hypertension, right. Which is an area where, there hasn't been a whole lot of change for quite a while.
Now, why is hypertension, Vince, and nephrology one and the same? What is it that they have to do with each other?
Well, there's an intimate relationship, and it goes both ways. Sometimes hypertension can cause chronic kidney damage, and sometimes chronic kidney disease can cause hypertension. So, again, a very close relationship there.
Okay. And I've known a lot of people who died. I'm sorry about this, to say it this way. But almost always when you get old, one of the reasons is kidney failure. What's that about?
Well, as we get older, about a small fraction of the kidney function is lost every year after you turn 30. And so as the population gets older and older, the amount of people or the number of people who have some degree of abnormal kidney function rate rises all the time.
How do you know if you got a bad kidney?
You may not. You may not. And that's why screening programs are important. National Kidney Foundation sponsors kidney screening programs throughout the community where they check blood pressure, which, again, can be responsible for kidney damage. They check urine. And looking at the urine, sometimes there can be signs of kidney damage, like protein in the urine, that kind of thing.
Gotcha. Okay, let's go to Roberta in Greenfield. All right, Roberta, you're on. Take it.
Hello.
Hello, you're on.
By protein in the bloodstream, do you mean albumin?
Hi, Roberta.
Hi.
So, yeah, albumin is one of the body proteins that we do measure. Now, one of the things that we look for in people who may have chronic kidney disease is albumin and sometimes other proteins in the urine.
Now, how could this escape regular doctors? I'm calling for my friend Bob, and he went to 6 different doctors within 5 years, and they all did blood tests and everything else, and nobody even raised an eyebrow at high levels of albumin in his blood. Do regular doctors not know about this?
Well, albumin is one of the tests that are it's sometimes in panels. So sometimes a doctor can order a blood test that has a lot of different tests incorporated into it. So albumin is a common one. So now, it would be surprised if that was never checked. It's not really a concern to have high levels of albumin in the blood. What we're looking at in terms of chronic kidney disease is losing albumin into the urine. And many times when that happens, the level of albumin in the blood drops.
And that's because the kidney can't handle the albumin, and it spills over to the into the urine.
Yeah, if you think of the kidney as a filter, mm-hmm. like any other filter, some things can pass through that filter and some things can't.
Now, what's the relationship, Vince, between the kidney and the bladder?
Well, these are things in order to be able to evacuate or get rid of mostly salt and water, but also other byproducts of our metabolism. So as the kidneys are filtering the blood, they're creating the urine in its earliest stages, which then goes on to form and travel down two tubes, one from each kidney, traveling to the bladder, which is where that urine is stored and then later evacuated. So the bladder is kind of a holding area for the urine.
Now we've heard about bubbles in the urine. What is that?
The more protein like albumin that you have in the urine changes what's called the surface tension. So in a similar way, if you put some soap into your, you know, sink water, you see bubbles. And the same idea is true. As there's more albumin in the urine, it changes that surface tension and you can see very foamy urine in the toilet.
Okay, Roberta, you done?
No, I have another question.
Sure.
My friend is very frustrated because sitting in the chair, it's like a factory where the chair hurts him very badly. It hurts his back. He has to sit there for 4 hours. They run it just standard, 4 hours, and then at the end of that time, he's so dehydrated that then they have to put more back into him. He wants to get off of it. Is there anything that cures kidney disease other than a transplant?
Well, it's a very good question, and clearly transplant is the best option that we have to eliminate the need for dialysis. But I think your friend may have some options, and it's clearly true that dialysis is not a perfect treatment, as most treatments are not perfect. One of the things that's required is to be in one place for a certain number of hours. And so many people, especially elderly people or people who don't move around a lot, may have some sores or bad back or something like that, which makes it uncomfortable to be there for a long period of time. Now, what some people do is they bring special pillows with them to the dialysis units, which oftentimes people are sitting in lounge chairs, kind of that kind of chair. Another possibility, and again, I don't know the specifics for your friend, but there are other ways to do dialysis other than being in the center. And one of those options would be to do dialysis at home. Some people are able to do hemodialysis, which it sounds like this is the type of dialysis your friend is doing in their home. And there are other ways to do these treatments at home too, which might, you know, provide a more comfortable environment.
Is that expensive?
It's not any more expensive for most patients.
Do you rent the unit or do you buy the unit?
It's generally covered by the patient's insurance.
Oh, I see. Roberta?
And what is the name of the unit?
Well, different dialysis units would use different systems. So I would check with the unit that he's dialyzing with, and they would give him some options potentially for home dialysis if he was a good candidate for that.
Well, he's 67 years old. Does that make any difference?
No, he's certainly a young enough individual to be able to do that kind of therapy at home, assuming
very
that...
Very active.
Yeah.
Okay, Roberta, we got a lot of people behind you. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Okay, and let's go to Joseph in Rotterdam. Okay, Joseph, you're on.
Hi, I got a question. My wife has a complex kidney cyst, and I was wondering if that was anything to worry about.
The answer to the question is yes. And, you know, there are different types of cysts that we sometimes see in kidneys, and sometimes we see them randomly when we're not looking for them. And a cyst, if you can imagine, is kind of like a bubble that forms in the kidney's tissue. Now, if it's a what they call a simple cyst, it's like a simple bubble, and a lot of times it's just filled with fluid. It doesn't represent a lot of pathology. It doesn't mean that you have a disease. When a cyst is described as complex, this means that it could be something else. Worst case scenario, it could represent a cancer. And so this is something that for sure needs to be followed up, may need the help of a urologist for that.
Joseph, are you following up?
Yes, she is following up. They told her it was a stage 2. Does that make any difference?
Not so much to me, but to someone like a urologist who would potentially be treating or removing a cyst, it would be.
Why a urologist and not a kidney, a nephrologist?
Both types of physicians work on kidneys, and many will all say, you know, we're kidney doctors, yes. But different focus. A nephrologist is focusing on the functional aspects of the kidney. A urologist, as far as the kidney goes, many times is focused on the anatomy and whether or not if surgery is needed. Okay. And so that's why many cancers are treated by urologists.
One last question. Her mother has cysts. Is this hereditary?
Some forms of cysts can be hereditary. In general, the most common form of hereditary kidney disease that involves cysts is called polycystic kidney disease, which in many families is a very dominant problem where many people in the family will all have it, and it's very well known usually within families. Complex cyst, especially if it's one, this is probably not that type of disease.
Now, Dr. Carcillo, if in fact Joseph describes his wife's cyst as stage 2, does that imply cancer?
I don't know, to be honest with you, who staged the kidney and what they meant by that staging system. Okay. So, you know, cancer is the worst case scenario. This is something that a urologist would want to look at the film to get a better idea.
Okay. Joseph, thanks.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Okay. Let's go to Carol in. No, let's take a fast break, 7 seconds or so. We'll be right back. 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Premier Medical Group, gastroenterology, urology, internal medicine, endocrinology, geriatrics, nephrology, and pulmonology, with offices throughout the Hudson Valley. PremierMedicalHV.com. Mount St. Mary College in Newburgh, master's and online RN to BS in nursing degree programs for adult students, post-master's nurse practitioner certificates in adult and family health, msmc.edu. Nathan Litauer Hospital, Gloversville, New York, now presenting their Renaissance Robotic System for minimally invasive spine surgeries with Dr. Ja'an Shen, nlh.org. And Marriott Town Place Suites, Albany, downtown, offering studio, 1- and 2-bedroom suites with fully equipped kitchens. Amenities include indoor pool, breakfast, local transportation, Wi-Fi, and parking. TPSAlbany.com for reservations.
We're back. That's great. Thank you, Zachary. Didn't see the light. Okay, we're with Dr. Vincent Carcillo, and he is terrific. And you can hear that he's a very thoughtful fellow. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Carol in Troy. Carol, you're on.
Hi. Where are the kidneys located in the body? And could you kindly describe the kidneys' size and shape and how hard are they or how soft are they?
Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, your kidneys are located in a place that's called the retroperitoneal space. And so, you know, it's a long word to describe the place that's kind of in your back. If you were to put your hand on your lower part of your rib cage, it would be deep to that area of your back. And you have one kidney on either side.
In other words, one on the right side of the body and one on the left.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. And how big are they and what shape are they?
So they're shaped like a bean, right? Like the kidney bean. And so the shape is actually very similar to that. And the kidneys, if you make a fist, generally your kidney is about that size.
The size of a bean?
No, the size of a fist, yeah.
Shaped like a bean, size of your fist.
I never thought of that's why we call them kidney beans, because they look that way. Carol, anything else?
Not at the moment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Call again. Okay, thank you for that. And we'll go to Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Okay, Jim, you're on.
What effects do NSAIDs have on the kidneys, and where is the locus of action?
Hi, Jim. So non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, these are generally over-the-counter pain medicines. Some of them are prescription only, but they're medicines that are usually used for pain or inflammation. they do, or at least can have, some effects on the kidneys. In most people, especially people who have normal kidney function, they're absolutely safe. In people who have some specific issues like chronic kidney disease or high blood pressure or protein in the urine, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications can sometimes make those problems worse. So we use them with caution, or we advise, especially elderly patients or patients who do have chronic kidney disease, to use those medications with caution, or sometimes not use them at all. As far as the location of action, the area in the kidney is actually an area that's attached to the tiny filtering unit that's called a glomerulus, and there are about a million of them in each one of your kidneys. Each one of those glomerulus units is filtering the blood. And so there's a small blood vessel that brings blood to them and one that brings them away. And the non-steroidals affect the blood vessel that's bringing the blood to them.
Hey there, Frank. What about the effects on diabetics?
Well, many diabetics who have chronic kidney disease also have some protein in their urine. And so the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications can sometimes make the kidney function worse. Sometimes it can make protein in their urine worse as well.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jim. Okay, everybody, your chances of getting in to talk to Dr. Vince Carcillo now are excellent. I mean, really excellent. 1-800-348-2551. So, Vince, I wanted to ask you this. I've often been confused about who can do what in terms of giving away a kidney. It's forbidden to sell one, right?
Absolutely. It's illegal to sell a kidney.
You sell a kidney. But if you tell your brother comes to you and says, okay, can I have your extra kidney, you would say yes, and you would have no problem directing the kidney towards somebody as long as they're not paying for it, right?
You certainly could, and that could be a brother, and that could be a spouse. It could be someone that you've never met.
But now comes the interesting question. What if somebody, you are willing to give it to somebody, even a first-degree relative, it turns out that they have a bit different blood type than you do? Is there a way around that?
Well, we're doing a lot of creative things right now in the transplant community. And in some instances like that, let's say, for instance, you wanted to donate a kidney to a brother or a spouse, but you found out that you're not the right blood type, for instance. Well, there may be another pair out there in the world somewhere that you've never met that is in the same situation. They're not a good match for each other, but you might be able to share those organs between the four of you, or six of you, or eight of you, and be able to pair organs between people who've not met, who are good matches for each other, but not necessarily a match for the person you're intimately associated
with. Well, all five phones are ringing, but I wanted to ask you really quickly. So is there an organization that does that? Let's say you say, I want to get my brother a kidney. This is his blood type, but mine is different. So they can arrange that sort of daisy chain for you.
They can, and then there's also a way to, for some people who may be, altruistic in nature, who want to donate a kidney to someone that they've never met, and the National Kidney Foundation is sponsoring a website to help organize that. It's actually at www.kidneyconnection.org.
Sounds great.
It's a free site that connects those type of people. So a person who's in need of a kidney transplant, maybe someone who's on dialysis, can put up their picture, can post their story, and let the community at large know that they need an organ and why. And so someone could go on that site and say, I would like to donate a kidney, and that can get worked out.
That sounds terrific. Let's go to Jamie in Syracuse. Okay, Jamie, you're on.
Hi, hello.
Jamie. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, doctor. How are you?
Hi, Jamie. Good, thanks. How are you?
Good. I have a question. Recently, my 15-year-old son went to the doctors and had a blood test done, which showed he had elevated BUN and creatinine. 1.3 was his creatinine, and his BUN was 45. I brought him because he was having some fatigue, but he was taking L-arginine. It's an amino acid for weightlifting. And I wasn't sure if that would have been causing it.
Well, I was going to ask you if your son was heavily involved in athletics.
He is. He goes to the gym and he weightlifts a couple hours, five times a week.
I can give you some general perspectives on what may be going on. And so,
Okay. You
know, those numbers that you mentioned, one was BUN and the other one is creatinine, they're different numbers, but both have relationships to what's going on with the kidney. That BUN number is something that's called the blood urea nitrogen. So nitrogen has to do with protein. And so the more protein that we take in, the more nitrogen that we have in our system. And so that number can change based on the protein that you have in your diet. It can also change when you become less than well hydrated. And so a lot of times athletes especially, you know, can be underhydrated and they can see that number rise. Creatinine can also rise when you're less well hydrated. It can also rise in the setting of primary kidney diseases too. So, you know, it's something to take seriously and something that a nephrologist should really kind of carefully go over with them.
But creatinine is more to your fear than the BUN number?
The BUN.
Many times it is. You know, creatinine is something that actually, although we use it as a marker for kidney function, is something that doesn't even really come from kidneys. It comes from our muscles. And so every day as the muscles are active, this is kind of a waste product of their metabolism. It becomes a great marker because everybody has it in their blood. And every day you make more, every day the kidneys are able to eliminate more, and so your levels should stay the same. When that number starts to rise, it may be an indicator that, hey, kidneys aren't doing as well a job as they were.
Jamie, thank you. There's so many people behind you, I can't even
believe it.
Thanks
again. Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah, bye. Let's go to John in Del Mar. John in Del Mar, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You may have already dealt with this at some level, but when you were talking about kidney transplants, I have a friend who is now about the age of 70, and 10 years ago she donated a kidney. Which I think was a very generous act. And she doesn't seem to have any ill effects at all. She seems to be leading quite a vibrant life, traveling all over and so forth. And my question is, how does living on one kidney, whether you're a recipient or a donor, affect your life? How can you do it?
Well, thanks, John. It's a good question. You know, and there are two different subsets of people that you mentioned. One would be those who receive the transplant that have one organ that's functional. In most cases, they now have three organs because they still continue to have their old native kidneys, which they don't remove in most settings in transplantation, and then they have a new kidney. The other person has given up a kidney. And so, you know, the person who is the donor, in most instances, once they give up a kidney, assuming that they don't have any signs or risk factors for kidney disease of their own, can live a normal life with just one kidney.
But of course, everybody is always thinking, what if I need that second kidney again, right? I mean, there's always that specter in your mind.
Absolutely, and that's why there needs to be a lot of scrutiny when someone says, I would like to be a donor, to make sure that they're a good candidate, that they're a very low risk for something like that to happen.
And there are people who reject kidneys. I know some of them. In other words, you get one, it looks good, but it doesn't take. What's that about?
Absolutely. Again, a transplant is also not a perfect treatment. Yeah. And in some people, the transplant doesn't work, and they would call it kind of a primary non-functional transplant. In other people, it works, but it works slowly, and so maybe they still require some dialysis for a time until the kidney really starts to take over and do that work.
Are we getting any closer to an artificial kidney in the body as opposed to dialysis?
Well, you know, we are, I think. We're not quite there yet, but they're out of University of California, San Francisco. You know, they've created a wearable or implantable artificial kidney that they're beginning some clinical trials.
Interesting, interesting. John, anything else?
Well, I just wanted to clarify that a healthy person, it sounds like their one remaining kidney does the work of the previous two.
You're absolutely right.
Okay, thank you.
John, thanks for the great call. Appreciate
it.
Yeah, okay, that leaves two free phones open. Let's go to Mike in Marbletown, 1-800-348-2551. Mike, you're on.
Thanks. I just had a question about the relationship between, you know, strep throat and tonsil infection and kidney disease. We were told you know, to remove tonsils because that could be a possibility. Is that true?
Well, there can be a relationship. I would tell you that most people who have strep infections, and we all know or have had strep infections ourselves, that they don't cause kidney problems. But in few people, the immune system reacts in such a way that the kidney can become affected, and the kidney function can deteriorate after a strep infection. For most people, that's not a problem, though. It's also not a reason for most people to have their tonsils removed.
Thank you.
Could I ask a second question?
Go ahead, Mike.
Sure. The kidneys, can they be affected by significant medications over time? You know, like in treating, say, strep throat or something like that, you know, an amoxicillin or a penicillin.
A lot of medications can impact kidney function, and antibiotics are certainly medications that can do that. In many instances, though, it's almost as you could think of it as an allergic reaction that they're having. So it's usually not a problem that happens over a long period of time, usually after kind of a short-term exposure to a medicine like that.
Okay, Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Doctor, can taking magnesium citrate 200 milligrams a day harm the kidneys over time of a 65-year-old woman with no known kidney disease? This came in at WMC.org, at VoxPop at WMC.org. Go ahead.
In most instances, absolutely not. Magnesium is a safe supplement to take. I would suggest taking magnesium if your doctor has determined that you're deficient in magnesium or that you are at risk for doing that, maybe someone who's on a diuretic therapy, which is what we commonly refer to as water pills, people can tend to get deficient in magnesium. If your magnesium levels are normal, you likely do not need to take supplementation. If you had chronic kidney disease, magnesium supplementation can sometimes become a problem where you build up too much magnesium in your system.
Interesting. We'll go to Mike in Glens Falls. Okay, Mike, you're on.
Hello, Mike. Doctor. I had a question if there is a direct correlation between high total cholesterol numbers and kidney function or failure. I'm going to hang up for the answer.
No. Do you have to?
I'm driving.
Okay, yeah, hang up before you get a ticket. Go ahead, Mike. Go ahead, Vince.
A good question, Mike. So, cholesterol, the relationship potentially between cholesterol and chronic kidney disease has more to do with the plaques that we think of in the blood vessel walls. In many people, we think of those plaques when we talk about heart attacks and that kind of thing. And those plaques don't happen in a vacuum. They don't just happen in the heart. You can imagine that they're happening in all the little blood vessels in the body. And so over time, atherosclerotic disease, which is the term we use to describe that, can happen in the kidney, starving some areas of the kidney of blood supply. And certainly that can cause some chronic kidney damage.
Okay. And thank you, Mike. And on to Diane in New Salem. Okay, Diane, you're on. Hi, Diane. Hello. I bet Diane is listening on her radio, which has a 7-second delay, which is why you have to stay on the phone. Okay, Diane, we're sorry. And that will now bring us to Joan in Queensbury. Joan in Queensbury, 1-800-348-2551. Three free phones. Go, Joan.
Hi. My question is, you were talking about people donating kidneys.
Yep.
And I'm wondering how much of an operation is that for the donor? It's not like going and giving a pint of blood, right? It's big.
Hi, Joan. Yeah, it certainly is. It's an operation that we take very seriously. And between the transplant center and the nephrologist that evaluates potential donors, we want to make sure that every donor is going to be a good candidate to go through surgery and that they understand what kind of procedure this is. This is removing a major functional organ from your body. So it's definitely a significant operation. Now, that being said, if it's determined that you are a good candidate, almost everyone that goes through the procedure does very well.
How long are you laid up or in the hospital?
Sometimes just a few days, and then depending on pain control and any potential complications, up to a week or so.
So it's really major surgery.
It certainly is.
Well, you know, you get all enthusiastic about the idea of donating a kidney, but I guess you got to get to the reality of it, too.
Well, it's true. You need to be realistic about what you're doing, and it is a big deal. And the things to consider are your own health, whether or not you're a good candidate for your own kidney reasons to go through a procedure like that. But again, I would tell you that if all of those things, all of those questions are satisfied, most people do great with that procedure.
Is there an upper age limit, or?
It generally has to do with the wellness of the candidate, both for donation and for recipients.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joan. All five phones are ringing, so that gives us one free phone. We're going to take a short break, and we will be right back.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, a comprehensive healthcare network served by more than 600 physicians, reinventing healthcare one patient at a time. 1-844-518-DOCS for appointments and referrals. Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs, hosting an open house Saturday, April 12th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. St. Francis Hospital Medical Arts Pavilion, adelphi.edu. Vision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and more. Where eyewear is an art, Facebook or visionexceleyecare.com. And Bard's Fisher Center, presenting Summerscape 2014 opera Oirianta by Carl Maria von Weber, directed by Kevin Newbery, July 25th through August 3rd. Box office now open, fishercenter.bard.edu.
And we are back. Good for you. And Zach, and let's go to Nancy in Tivoli. Nancy in Tivoli, you're on. There are two free phones, by the way. Go ahead, Nancy. 1-800-348-2551. Now go, Nancy.
Yes. Thank you, doctor. This might sound rather simplistic, but why do you think we have two kidneys when we have one gallbladder and one spleen and one everything else? Why do you think we were given two kidneys?
Hi, Nancy. No, I think it's a fine question. And honestly, there is some redundancy there. When we think of the major work that's done by this organ system, it does make some sense to have that redundancy. Remember, kidneys are filtering your blood, and they're filtering a whole lot every minute. And so as they're doing that, they're removing all the salt and water that you're taking in your body. And besides that, besides just getting rid of that salt and water, they've got other functions too. Some of those functions are what we call endocrine. They make hormones that sometimes control your ability to make new blood cells. And so they do a whole host of things. And so over time, as we lose kidney function, it is important to have that redundancy.
Okay, thank you. But let me, since you said the hormones, the adrenal gland sits on top of the kidneys, doesn't it? Is there a reason why they're connected? The adrenals are a part of the kidney functioning?
The kidneys are not necessarily a part, or the adrenal glands are not necessarily a part of the kidneys functioning, but they do have relationships, and some of those relationships are related to blood pressure control.
I see. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Nancy.
You're welcome.
All right, we go to Gregory in Kingston. Okay, Gregory.
Yeah, hi. I listened to a show, I don't know if it was Medical Monday or something else in the past, and I remember somebody talking about that they had donated a kidney to a friend who really needed it from their heart. They really wanted to do this, and then they ended up with problems with their insurance. Either they couldn't get it or escalated or something like that, and I can't remember the details exactly. I thought it was important to bring up.
Reaction.
Sure. Gregory, you know, as far as insurance goes, you know, again, I would say that most of the people who donate a kidney do absolutely fine and don't have significant health-related problems related to their donation. one of the things that is important, and that, you know, as we go through National Kidney Month, the National Kidney Foundation does have a New York State Advocacy Day on March 18th. One of the things that they hope to achieve is good coverage for transplant medications for recipients down the road, years after the transplant is received, so that they can continue to take those medicines that they need for their body not to reject the organ.
I was talking about the donor having a problem with getting insurance.
Yeah, in that regard, you know, most donors, like I said, they don't have a lot of health-related issues related to their donation, so they would be very similar to the general population as far as their insurance needs.
It just seemed like something I should bring up. All right, thank you.
Thanks, Gregory.
Thank you.
Okay, 1-800-348-2551 at WAMC.org. Bob C. says, are postmortem kidneys suitable for transplant?
Postmortem kidneys.
In other words, after you're dead, right? I think that's what it means here. You know, like other people leave their eyes and other things to science or for transplant. Can you do that with kidneys after somebody's dead?
I just want to make it clear as far as the terms that we use. You know, what we like to use is the term deceased donors. And so if someone does pass away,
yeah,
and they're a good candidate to donate an organ, then absolutely.
If they've left that in their will. Yeah.
Sure, or on their license, or,
yeah,
you know, in some way designated that they would like to be an organ donor, then in many cases those are good kidneys. And oftentimes those kidneys they always get evaluated by transplant teams to make sure that they think that those are good, viable organs. When I hear the term post-mortem, as a physician, I generally think of autopsy. And so at the point where a person gets to gets to an autopsy, those organs have been deceased for a long time, and so they would not be viable.
Right. Okay, thank you. That's a great answer. Let's go to Diane in New Salem. Okay, Diane, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hey.
This question is about my bladder.
Okay.
I'm 64-year-old, and it seems in the morning I can urinate fine, but there's still a lot left in my bladder, and I have to actually work at emptying it. Now, I'm pretty sure I don't have a prostate, so I was wondering what that could be caused by.
Mm-hmm. So, now, do you feel the need to urinate frequently?
Not excessively.
There are different things to consider. Sometimes, especially in females, you know, females obviously they do not have a prostate, but females can have infections, which can sometimes do this. Sometimes people can get kind of dilated bladder, which makes it more difficult to fully empty. And some people, both men and women, can get overactive bladders, and so there can be a number of problems. It sounds like it's been a problem enough for you that it's impacting your life, and for sure I would get it looked at. You can start with your primary care doctor. You may need a urologist as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And at WAMC.org, if you've got kidney stones, does that disqualify you from donating a kidney?
In some instances, it does, and some people make multiple stones over time. And it's something that gets looked at very carefully by the nephrologist and the transplant team, but oftentimes it does disqualify you.
Also, by internet, is it possible to remove one of your own kidneys and save it for later in your life?
That is not possible. The kidney's viability is very, very short term once it's removed from the body.
Gotcha. Okay, let's go to Joseph in Northampton. Okay, Joseph, you're on.
Hi, it's actually Josh. How you doing?
Josh. Oh, I'm sorry, Josh. My fault.
No problem. You know, a year ago today, I donated a kidney. And it was a great experience, and I did use the that exchange program. And my friend ended up with an excellent match. So that's something beneficial about not being a direct donor as well. They can find the better match for you. I have a question, though. They told me to not go crazy on protein intake, you know, no protein shakes, things like that. And I was wondering, I mean, I don't eat excessively anything in particular, but should I be adjusting my diet beyond just, you know, no protein shakes? Is there too many hamburgers I should eat or not eat, or anything along those lines?
Well, Josh, let me start out by saying that I think it's very noble what you did, and I'm very happy to hear that your friend is doing so well. Now,
thanks.
As far as protein for you, now we're talking about protein in the diet, but I'm also curious to know, have doctors suggested that you had any protein in your urine?
I don't remember them pointing out anything in particular. I think it was just generally moving forward after the donation, what I should be doing as a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. And blood pressure is normal?
Yeah, a little low.
A little low. I wouldn't be overly concerned with restricting protein intake. Now, oftentimes when we are loading our bodies with protein, this can put some stress on kidneys. And so you have one kidney, and so that's probably not necessary for you to do that in any way, whether it's for weight loss reasons or otherwise, or other ways to do that. So, you know, most people would say that you don't need to load your body with protein. But at the same time, you know, if hamburger or something else, other kinds of protein is something that you like to eat, I wouldn't necessarily restrict it.
Thank you.
All right, that's great.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go to Andre in Westfield, Massachusetts. Westville, Massachusetts. Andre.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling about my wife. She went to the emergency room about a week ago with abdominal pain. And there, they did a CAT scan and diagnosed her with enlarged kidney on the left side. And also, I think the cause was the blocked urethra because it was also enlarged. Now, she followed up with a urologist who performed a procedure on the general anesthesia, and he said the urethra was not blocked. Now, the next thing he wanted to do is a dynamic renal scan, which she kind of hesitates to do. She thinks maybe it wasn't anything that she should worry about. That's the basic question. Is this enlarged kidney and also enlarged urethra could be caused by just general inflammation, general cold symptoms? Or is that something that should really be checked out and followed up all the way through?
Well, she should definitely continue to follow up. One of the things that, especially when I heard pain, that I would be concerned about was infection. You know, sometimes you can have infection in the urine, which makes its way back to the kidney, and that can cause some of the things that you're describing. There can also be blockages. Now, when you think of a blockage and you think of these large organ or dilated, tubes, we mentioned one of them that's called a urethra. Urethra is the tube between the bladder and the outside world. Now, the other tube that leads from the kidney to the bladder is called the ureter, and they can sometimes dilate too. And you can think of that as, you know, if you were to crimp your garden hose. As you do that and there's water flowing through there, the pressure backs up. And it's the same idea. If there's a blockage and you're making urine from the kidneys, the pressure backs up and things tend to look dilated. And so you're doing the right thing by following up with the urologist. Specifics of what they're finding, that I couldn't tell you, but, you know, it's something that you don't want to let go.
Yes, the part that was enlarged was actually between the kidney and the bladder.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of what is a dynamic renal scan, what can it diagnose as a test?
Well, you know, it's going to be looking. Most times they do a scan that's called a flow scan, and so this is a scan that uses kind of nuclear material to look at how well the kidneys take things in from the blood and then excrete them into the urine and watch their progression. So, if there's a question of blockage, many times a scan like that can be helpful.
How do you unblock?
All depends on what's going on. If it's something like a stone, sometimes that can be removed. It's something that's compressing the tube from the outside, like a tumor, obviously that would need to be addressed. In gentlemen, sometimes it's the prostate that's causing a blockage by crimping that tube that's called the urethra. And again, there are different treatments for all of those things.
Andre, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
And we'll go to Gary in Yulin, New York. Okay, Gary, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. I have two questions. Number one is there a level of protein in the urine that's accepted, that's okay? And number two, is there any other reason for protein in the urine besides having a kidney issue?
Hi, Gary. So, you know, your question is about protein in the urine. And so,
yeah.
You know, as far as acceptable levels, like any other test, the lab will always have a normal range. You shouldn't see protein in the urine on standard testing. So if you were to go to your primary care doctor and have a basic urine test, they do a test that's called a urine analysis. And that's basically a dipstick test. So similar to the way you would check your pool for chlorine, it's a chemical test where you dip a strip into the urine and you look to see if there's chemical changes. If there's protein above a certain level, well, then that chemical strip changes color, and it's obvious, okay, we have protein above an acceptable level. You know, when we do more sophisticated testing, like collecting your urine for a 24-hour period, there are numbers that are acceptable, usually less than 150 milligrams in a 24-hour period. But again, that's getting a little bit more specific. Now, as far as whether or not you could have protein in your urine for reasons that are not diseases, there can be. And in some people, especially young people, they can see what's called orthostatic proteinuria, which is what generally when they're awake and they're standing up, they've got some protein in their urine. And when they're asleep and lying down, that protein goes away. And there are ways that we can figure that out. And that's kind of a benign process, a process that doesn't cause kidney failure or other disease over time. So there are some possibilities, but in most individuals, if protein is seen in the urine, it is a very serious thing and something that needs to get worked up.
Well, what would be the next step if it was detected in a general urine test?
Mm-hmm. So if it was detected in a general urine test, if we know there's protein in the urine, the next question is always, well, how much? And so there are ways to quantify that, and those are ways that sometimes a primary care doctor can take care of. Sometimes they'll send you to a nephrologist to assess that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
you're
Gary.
We'll go now to Carol in Greenwich. Okay, Carol, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Hi, doctor.
Hi.
Many years ago, I ran into two people almost back-to-back, and they had a kidney removed. And when I asked them, have you noticed anything different, both of them, and this is independent of each other, said, yeah, I don't feel like eating chicken anymore. And I didn't know if you've ever heard of that, if it's the brain saying cut down on the protein, what do you think that might have been about?
Okay, Carol, let me just rephrase the question to Dr. Carcillo. So tell me, have you ever heard of relationships between kidneys and chickens?
Kidney removal and the aversion to eating chicken.
Yeah.
Hi, Carol. So yeah. The way I guess I would answer that is that if they'd had a kidney removed and had chronic kidney disease, especially more advanced chronic kidney disease can cause you to lose your appetite, and some people will feel more specific orientations towards food. So that's probably the closest I could come. Other than that, there's no association between chicken and a kidney removal, that kind of thing.
Carol, I'm going to let you go because we only got one more person on the line. I want to give him a chance.
Okay.
All righty.
Okay, let's go to Susan in Albany. Susan, you go.
Yes, hello. I'm wondering, I had a colonoscopy 10 years ago, and I'm due for another one, but I had a bad reaction, I think, to the PrEP, the phosphate PrEP.
Yeah.
Now, I understand that they don't use this anymore because it's of its association with kidney failure. I'm really quite scared about having another colonoscopy for this reason, and I'm wondering, is there any way that you can assess if there's been kidney damage? I had one test that indicated my kidney function was okay, but I really was in pain after the procedure, and I'm just very suspicious.
Okay. So now I just want to there's limited time, so I'm going to try to answer quickly.
Okay.
Many forms of acute kidney damage are best assessed with biopsy. And so it may be something that if this was a suspected thing that you would need to have. Other than that, you know, your gastroenterologist can work with your nephrologist if you have chronic kidney disease to make sure that you get the right PrEP.
Okay. Well, I thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Okay. Well, my friends, we're just about out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in. I'd also like to thank our very good friend, Dr. Vincent Carcillo, a terrific guy, for joining us today. Underwriting support for Vox Pop comes from Toprasin, pain relief creams that are natural biomedicine formulas bridging the gap between conventional medical care and natural medicine, Toprasin.com. Thanks again for joining us, everybody. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. He's wearing his taxicab driver hat. He looks very distinguished. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. She's terrific, too. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall, but she's out today, so Ian Pickus is taking her place today. I'm Alan Chartok. Again, Vince Carcillo, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks again for having me.
Stay tuned now for a news update.